The largest edible fruit native to the United States was once a treat and source of sustenance for Native Americans, presidents, and enslaved African Americans. Today, it can still be freely foraged in the forests of 26 states. Chances are, though, you've never tasted and only ever sung about the pawpaw. Andrew Moore explores the economic, biological, and cultural reasons for our naivete about this singular fruit in his book, Pawpaw, In Search of America's Forgotten Fruit. He joins us now. Andrew, welcome to Living on Earth.
Steve, thanks for having me.
You've brought in your book, Pawpaw, In Search of America's Forgotten Fruit, and you've brought in a pawpaw.
Yes, a pawpaw itself. And this is maybe one of the last pawpaws that I'll be lucky enough to get this year.
Well, describe it for us, would you please?
It kind of looks to me like a small mango. It's very green. Some other people describe it. It kind of looks like a russet potato.
And it's really fragrant.
Really fragrant. The studio is really filled with the aroma now.
I'd describe it as almost a mango aroma as well. So I got to ask what it tastes like.
Sure. So you mentioned mango already, and a lot of people do describe it commonly as a cross between a banana and a mango. And what that's really getting at is that it has this unusual tropical flavor for an otherwise temperate fruit. And then, you know, the banana aspect gets at this creamy texture that the pawpaw has.
Well, can I find out?
Sure. Yeah. Do you want to cut into it?
Yeah. All right. Okay. You go ahead. You're the expert cutter here.
Well, the way I like to do it is to cut it in half, kind of like you might an avocado, and twist it apart like a double stuffed Oreo. And then when you do that, what you reveal is essentially 2 cups of custard. And the pulp, as you can see, is this vibrant yellow, near orange in some places. And then you've also revealed a few rows of seeds down the center of the pawpaw. And these are large, black, lima bean-sized seeds that you can pick around or pull apart.
Now, I think it's been 20 or 30 years since I've tasted a pawpaw. So here it goes. Well, that's really good.
Does it taste like you remember?
Yeah, it tastes, it's got this slight little tangy edge to the banana, but it's mango. But no, wait, it's banana. But wait, it's mango. And it's delicious. You know, there are a lot of things that one can do in life, Andy. Why have you spent so much time researching, traveling around, paying attention to the pawpaw? What drew you to the pawpaw?
When I learned about it, first of all, what happened was I was captivated. I was at the Ohio Pawpaw Festival, and out in the woods, outside of the festival fairgrounds, is a patch of wild pawpaws. And the experience of picking pawpaws from the trees, of picking them up from the ground, this wild bounty, this tropical-tasting fruit that I had never heard of, that none of my family or most of my friends had never really heard of this thing, I was fascinated that something this good, this large, it's the largest edible fruit in the Native American woods, that it could be so unknown. And so I just wanted to learn more. So I just kept researching and looking online, and I met the people who were working with pawpaws, and was certain that I wanted to write a story because I realized it had a really compelling human story as well.
So you started on a pawpaw quest. What's it like to go pawpaw hunting?
It's a lot of fun. And that was another reason why I set out writing the book, was just it was really fun to go to these places, whether it was wild patches on the banks of the Mississippi or whether it was Monticello and Mount Vernon or an experimental orchard where people were growing pawpaws and doing selective breeding. It was just a lot of fun to go to these places and meet these people.
By the way, describe the pawpaw tree for me. What's
sure.
It look like?
Yeah, the pawpaw tree, and again, it's confusing to me as to why it would be so unknown, because the tree is beautiful as well. It has this lovely pyramidal shape when grown in full sun, and it has these long tropical-looking leaves. They're among the broadest and longest leaves you'd find in the eastern forests. And in fall, they turn a striking yellow.
And where can you find pawpaws?
I often say that the pawpaw is a river fruit. It's native to 26 states in the eastern U.S., and many of these rivers in these states are, in fact, lined with pawpaws in the deep alluvial, rich soil. And so that's a good place to start looking for them.
So how come most of us have never heard of the pawpaw?
Right. Well, I call it the forgotten fruit. That's in the subtitle. Certainly some people have maintained memories of pawpaws. But for the most part, we stopped knowing pawpaws when we stopped going to the woods for food. In the middle of the last century, you know, with the rise of supermarkets and global food and industrialized foods, our diets became a lot more homogenized and industrial. And something that you would have to go to the woods to gather was left by the wayside. And pawpaw is not the only food, certainly, that we stopped eating and that we had neglected. you know, there were so many heirloom fruits and vegetables. You know, we had thousands of apples and old tomatoes. And so pawpaw is among those fruits that were lost, but that thankfully we're seeing a revival of.
So since it's free and available in the wild and such, what's your favorite survival story of somebody who needed the pawpaw to get over whatever challenge they were meeting?
Well, among the early stories are Lewis and Clark subsisting on pawpaws at the end of their expedition along the Missouri River. They had completely run out of food, and all they had was the wild bounty of pawpaws. And some people, when they talk about it, they'll say that the pawpaw saved them from hunger or they were near starvation. But in reality, there were just so many pawpaws that was never a concern. They were all content and happy and just eating pawpaws for 3 days.
So historically, how did Native Americans use the pawpaw?
Unfortunately, there's not a lot of citations for Native American foodways before Europeans. There are some citations that survive that we pawpaw people are thankful for. The Iroquois, for one, are cited as having dried pawpaws and cooked them into corn cakes, which I found fascinating because corn is low in niacin and pawpaw is high in this nutrient. It's high in antioxidants and some of the same antioxidants that are found in red wine and chocolate. We also know that it's high in, you know, various vitamins, vitamin A, C, potassium. These old folkways, they developed for a reason, and there's a lot of wisdom in them.
What's the relationship between the pawpaw and people of color?
Enslaved African Americans, they were looking to supplement diets if they had the liberty to pick things from the wild. Pawpaw would have been one of those things that they could have gathered each year, as well as, you know, on the Underground Railroad, slaves seeking freedom in the North. Pawpaw would have kept people alive as they were going north.
So as you went on your odyssey around America looking for pawpaw, how many festivals did you get to?
There were two prominent festivals that I went to when I was researching. The Ohio, which is a large gathering, now in its 17th year, around 8,000 people come out every year for that. And then in North Carolina, which was newer at the time, which is also growing. But now there's festivals in Rhode Island, in Maryland, in York, Pennsylvania. They're just popping up everywhere. And it's a really fun time for pawpaw people.
And how do people who hunted and ate pawpaws a long time ago, say as kids, how do they react now when they taste their first pawpaw in decades?
Oh, it's a really fun thing to share pawpaws with people who haven't had it in decades. You know, they remember it. They say, oh, I used to love eating these as kids. We'd go on the river and pick them. Or, you know, if they were coming home from school, this was candy for them. You know, they didn't have access to all these sweet foods like we do today. So it was such a cherished treat. And it really seems like a personal fruit. Everyone has these personal memories of gathering pawpaws. And I think some of that has to do with the fact that children, they did wander and gather these, but they were also shown this by loved ones, grandparents or parents. It was like a family tradition to go and gather these things.
The pawpaw place.
Yes, the pawpaw place, the picking place.
What are the various ways that people eat and I guess can even drink pawpaws these days, huh?
Yeah, these days, the sky's the limit with what you can do with pawpaw. And, you know, it's an interesting time. There are some great recipes out there, but I think the best things that you can do with a pawpaw are perhaps yet to be seen as people start experimenting with it. I make a pretty good pawpaw ice cream, pawpaw gelatos, sorbets. These are all very wonderful. Creme brulee, even. And recently at the Ohio Festival, I tasted pawpaw cello, so like a limoncello, a hard pawpaw lemonade. And there were 11 pawpaw beers on hand. I didn't get a chance to drink all of them.
That's right. I mean, good sweet fruit can lead to booze.
Booze, absolutely. And that's a tradition that goes as far back as, you know, the 1800s. People around Pittsburgh and in the Ohio Valley down through Ohio were making pawpaw brandy and liquor and beer. And it's been known to be a strong alcohol, even from those days on through today.
Pawpaw kapow.
Yeah, that's right.
What are some of the challenges of cultivating and marketing pawpaws?
Often it's said that the pawpaw's short shelf life and its fragility is why it has not been cultivated. That's a good starting place for talking about problems in domesticating the pawpaw. It is soft and it does have a short shelf life. So it's not necessarily a fruit that lends itself well to sitting on the back of a truck and going to distribution centers and then sitting on a supermarket shelf for several weeks. So it's just going to have a different niche. It's maybe not going to be something that's found in every Walmart across the country, but it's more likely something that will be found at farmers markets and local food co-ops.
And on the menu of perhaps a local restaurant.
Absolutely. And we're seeing that more and more from New York to Missouri, chefs are adding it into their menus and doing wonderful things with it.
Now, at one point in your book, you write about Neil Peterson working to improve pawpaw traits. Tell me a bit of his story.
Sure. He's often described as a Johnny Pawpaw Seed kind of character. He was a grad student at WVU, and he tasted his first pawpaw along the banks of the Monongahela. And like myself and like so many others, he was excited and eager to learn more. And as a plant scientist and as a horticulturalist, Neil had the skills to try to do something with it. And so he set about doing a breeding experiment. And he started crossing the country himself, seeking out old plantings and old cultivars from 50, 60 years ago, when people had a greater interest in pawpaw and had started selecting pawpaws and naming them. So he planted two orchards with well over 1,000 trees, and after several decades, selected the best pawpaws and released them to the public. Neil named his pawpaws after American rivers with Indian names in tribute to the original horticulturalists of the fruit. So Susquehanna, Shenandoah, Potomac, those are Neil's pawpaws, and they're considered by many to be among the best that are available.
Andy, could you please read from your book?
I'd be happy to.
Just describe for me what's going on here when this search for the Keter fruit.
Yeah, in Ironton, Ohio, I had been looking for the lost Keter fruit. It was the prize-winning fruit from the 1916 contest for the best pawpaws in America, and I spent about 3 days searching for it. In the morning, after a biscuit and fried apple breakfast, I decided to look for the trees planted by the uncle of my waitress at Jim's. Since the Keter fruit has thus far eluded me, it would be a boost to my sleuthing esteem to at least track down something. I find them, a massive pair, each 30 or 40 feet tall, reaching above the power lines, and more or less right where she said they would be, their leaves a deep green fading to yellow at the top of each pyramidal shape. They've managed to make a Bradford pear and black walnut look small in comparison. I stand in the grass, taking photos, when a neighbor calls out to me from her porch across the road. "Some people want to cut those trees down," she says. I ask why and who. "Just some neighbors on the block," she says. "They just want them gone, don't want them anymore." I told her I don't see any sense in that they are good trees. "Tell me about it," she says. I'm confused by all of it. But at least it offers some explanation as to why some things disappear. Whims of the obstinate.
How many of these do you have in your backyard now?
I have 3 trees in my backyard. It's a small backyard, otherwise I might have more.
And are they big enough to produce fruit yet?
I'm hoping to get my first fruit next year, actually. The flower buds have already formed, and I'll see them next spring, and hopefully we get some fruit.
So where is little Andy?
Way down yonder.
In his pawpaw patch, huh? Andrew Moore is a writer and gardener living in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, just within the range of the pawpaw. Pawpaw is his first book. Andy, thanks so much for taking the time.
Steve, thanks so much for talking to me.